Who do you cast as Mr. Tumnus?
In the Emerald Fennell version?
Yeah.
Barry Keoghan.
Yeah, you do. You
with
do.
With the horns and everything.
You know, totally, yeah.
And then you'd get
some ears in the,
Rosamund
in the,
Pike as the Ice Queen.
Oh my God. It's born to play.
Right, so Richard E. Grant as Aslan.
And the wardrobe.
Just with the mane.
The whole of Narnia.
Mocat. I want it mocat. Yeah. I want it on all fours. Purring. Yeah. We're back, George.
We are back. Sorry, in earnest. Scream. This is not our first episode of the year, but it is the first time we've seen each other to record since 2023.
How was your time off? Do you have a good time?
Yeah, it was fine. It was nice enough. Not as good as yours.
Last episode week, we lied. You asked me how my Christmas was, and I had to be like, well, I can't.
Yeah,
I don't know.
We were being mischievous. Mm. No, it was fine. It was nice. So, yes, this is going to be a different year. You know,
it's a new year.
It's a new year.
Opportunities.
New stuff. We're going for it, man. We're feeling excited.
Yeah.
But you had a very nice time.
Yeah, it was
in
great.
In the sun.
Some winter sun.
Would you like to tell people?
I was in Cape Town. You can follow my Instagram.
Look at that.
See such photos of you.
No. Not just like, oh, some photos. You took your drone.
I did.
And you took some drone photos. Yeah. You took Lonely Planet level photos of your own holiday. Yeah. And I thought any minute now, James is going to quit the podcast and move to Dubai and be one of those podcasters who just posts with their bum out in front of the Burj Khalifa, like it gets 200 million likes from it.
The drone is like my favorite toy ever. It's like it's so much fun. I sent it like way out. Like the furthest I've ever sent
the South African military had to like shoot it down.
So I was like, we were on the beach and I've never really been able to send my drone so far away because you have to have line of sight the whole time you do it. And there's nothing like line of sight, like the endless void of the ocean. So I was like, I'm going to send it all the way out. Obviously, like you get these as you're flying it, you always have the number of minutes left in your battery. And depending on how fast or how like much you're pushing it and if you're recording, that number sort of goes up and down. So I got to like, you get like 38 minutes on a battery and I got to like 8 minutes left and I'm like, cool, like it'll take a thing. And then at like 6 minutes it goes, oh, by the way, like battery you might want to think about. And I was like, cool. So I start bringing it back and it basically automatically comes back. And then it got to like really nearby. I'm talking like, you know, 20 meters in front of me in the villa in front, hovering over the villa in front. And it has the setting where it will never just drop out of the sky. Yeah. But instead it will just, when it's dead,
descend.
It will just descend slowly. And so I'm like bringing it in like almost there and all of a sudden I just lose control. The drone just goes like this into the tree of the villa in front.
No.
And I had to like knock on the door and be like, I'm so sorry. I don't know how to say this, but I accidentally crashed my drone into your tree. Can I come and get it? And the guy was like, yeah. He's like so not interested in helping me, but I was like, I'm really sorry.
Did he think you were like perving on him? You know, like some sort of surveillance thing.
He was
like,
British, which felt like I thought he could have sort of understood. I was just a bit of a guy. You know what?
If he's British and he's moved to South Africa, he's done. He's done talking to Brits, mate.
Oh, he's clocked out.
He's like, why are you here?
What I will say once again, I did do a long overnight flight,
yes.
11 hours yes. to Cape Town. I love to play this game with you where I have a quick look at what people are watching just to get us. It's always a really good census. When do you get to see what a few hundred people are watching at one time?
11 hours, or did you say, Drake?
So this is what you need to think about. It was a night flight, so 8:30 p.m. takeoff. Night flight, so everyone has to sleep and it's direct 11 hours.
And
so
it's the same time zone you're going to as well.
Same time zone. So you've got to think about people are going to probably watch one thing and then they're going to fall asleep, or they're going to fall asleep to something. So there were two films of note. One, which you'll probably get, which is one of the biggest films of the year. And number two, which I thought was interesting.
So Barbie.
Barbie was number one. People, I think, were re-watching Barbie because everyone saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And I reckon people are like, I'm going to fall asleep.
Yeah.
I'll enjoy some Barbie. Film number two. I'll give you a clue.
No, it's okay. Let me see if I can get it. Was it a big film of last year?
Big in what sense?
Popular.
It was.
So it wasn't Oppenheimer?
No. That's too much.
It's too much.
Too much brain. So
it's something you could relax to?
Yes.
With, is it the Jennifer Lawrence?
No, but that
no
would
hard
be
feelings.
Good.
Okay.
Didn't see that on there. But maybe not.
Give me a clue then.
It was a commercial and critical failure.
Oh, Indiana Jones.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is exactly the film I put on when I flew back from Florida. And I didn't finish it, but I even thought that opening 20 minutes, I thought, this is so dull. This is so boring.
But that works as like the second film that people would watch, because you go, I didn't see that, but I could totally go for very easy Indiana Jones.
Yeah,
if I fall asleep, sure.
Yeah.
I like Harrison Ford. I never did see that. Did you watch that? Yeah, I watched a bit of it on a plane, exactly as you said.
Yeah.
So I was like, yes, of course. It was like lots of pink and bright blue.
And then the
murky brown of just like, you know, Harrison Ford riding a horse through the...
It's not Harrison Ford riding the horse, is it? No. It's his face on some 35-year-old.
So that was the sort of new sense, the new plane census. I love it. I absolutely love seeing what
So what did you watch, though? Were you saving this for a bonus?
So my way...
Okay, I'm just going to say this. So this episode, we're going to be talking about new films, mm-hmm. namely Ferrari and...
Anyone But You.
Yeah, the Sydney Sweeney, Glenn Powell movie. Right. But we have a bonus episode coming out this week where James and I are just going to talk about every single film we watched and consumed over the Christmas New Year period, okay?
Yeah.
New and old. So those movies include...
Dirty Dancing.
Silence of the Lambs.
Blackberry.
Air.
May December.
The Thing.
I'm getting up my list. The Lobster.
Yes.
Annie Hall.
Right.
Dream Scenario.
And yes, and so you've caught up on some 2023 stuff, and you're also watched some old stuff, filled in some blanks.
Yes.
We'll be talking about those in the bonus. It's like surveying the buffet of films we engaged with.
There are two backlogs, George. There's the recently missed, and there's the endless pile of just choose any year. These just need to get
I think
done.
I said this in our episode before the end of the year, or last week's episode, whenever. The last time we recorded with each other, which is that I'm keen this year to make my... films that I've missed this year list much shorter.
Disappear.
So I'm going to try and see as many films as I can that come out this year. So when I get to the end of the year, my backlog... Otherwise, the eternal list is just going to grow and grow and grow.
You're it's not like, watching
you know
dumb
it is?
Money.
It's the difference between deficit and debt, isn't it?
Yes.
The deficit is this year's list. The debt is the eternal list.
Listen up, Jeremy Hunt. Yeah. He's like, oh my God.
I did watch Dumb Money as well. That was also my list.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think I roughly counted like over 80 films in 2023 or something.
Yeah, I'm about that.
It's about 1.6 films a week. But like some people email in and they're saying 200. Oh, are they counting rewatches?
They must be.
Because like that's insane.
They never go outside.
You just have to sit in film in the morning, film in the afternoon, film in the evening.
Well, this year I'm hoping that I can beat my all-time record. Beat my 2020 record.
It's 137,
maybe 140.
Yeah.
I want to get over 150 at least.
Wow, yeah.
Which I think I can do, because like...
So you'll need
necessity
to see...
we do this show, so there's always a need to see a film.
You'll need to see almost all the new releases, just as a baseline.
Mm. Yeah.
That'll get you to like 65.
Yeah.
The films you want to see that are out that are interested.
If I'm seeing one to two a week, let's say on average I'm seeing one new film a week, just on average. So that's 52 weeks done.
You don't have to pepper that with things you've not seen.
I could probably bump that up. So I could probably do... you're right. Let's do 70 films.
Just died, sorry. You keep talking.
I could do 70 films. I think I could do 70 new films and then fill up the rest with old ones maybe.
Okay, so you're including rewatches.
No. No. These are all new discoveries. Discoveries. Absolutely all new. I never count rewatches, but I'm already accepting the fact I will watch much fewer TV episodes, less TV, fewer episodes. Well, James has this thing. I don't know if anyone's ever picked up on this, but look, I'm an English graduate.
Can I just
say
George started the grammar correction?
No, I didn't. When
you correct me on my grammar constantly?
No, I don't.
Right?
No, I don't. I don't.
The evidence the evidence is 110 episodes.
No. Yeah. Redrafting an email with you
or not
is one
grammar?
Thing.
Not grammar. You'll just correct little things as I talk,
such as.
Or it could be any.
Oh,
no.
You know, it's not grammar. I will correct you if you mispronounce someone's name.
Yeah,
that's
that. In general.
But that's okay. That's acceptable because that's baseline fact. But look, I'm an English graduate. I'm confident in my command of English. But for some reason, in my entire education, the difference between less and fewer eluded me. Okay? And
I just have it. A lot of people don't use them correctly.
And I would say that, you know, I could pull you up on some of your grammar, James, but I don't. But you have learnt
for some reason. I just
you
have
know
it.
The difference between fewer and less.
And I'm not trying.
And whenever you see an opportunity to correct me on it, you do.
And because I know it really irritates.
It has worked because I do get better at it. But sometimes I will naturally slip out of it. But what you were hearing just then is my brain being like, I'm in James's presence. Quickly,
And for those who are wondering what the difference between less and fewer is, it's fewer when it's a definable quantity of something, and it's less when it's an overall. So as I said, less TV, TV is not a quantity of something, but it's TV episodes, that's fewer episodes.
If you can count them, fewer. So less beer, fewer
glasses.
Pints.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Less time, fewer years.
Mm. It's like fewer calories.
Yes.
Because you'd count them.
Less energy.
You can't say, oh, I consumed less calories today. No,
but
I consumed fewer calories.
Old
today.
Me would have done that, but you put me up on it.
I don't know why. I've not tried. I didn't one day be like, this will be my thing. I'm going to be the less and fewer guy.
Sometimes
you're just given divine knowledge.
I'm sorry if I've ever been overcorrecting of your grammar on air.
I love it.
But
never change.
Welcome to English 101. Anyway, let's get on with the show. We're going to be talking about Ferrari and anyone but you. Let's talk about them new movies.
Which one do you want to do first? Should we do anyone but you
first? Yeah, let's warm that one up.
So I actually went to go see this with Talia in Cape Town.
Right.
What's the cinema like? Yeah, it's like a standard multiplex. Cinema. I will say, we had the worst ever popcorn I've ever had.
Oh, God.
I've ever had. So you know how you've got like bag popcorn,
yes,
and then like proper popcorn,
yes,
and I consider
from
it
from the drum
from the drum, and I consider it the same as like a bottle of beer versus a pint.
Sure.
There's like a sort of, you know, made in that moment feel to it. I know it's like sort of all prepared for.
You're talking to someone, remember, I know how that popcorn from the drum is done.
Of course. Yeah. So in Cape Town,
I used to work at a cinema.
In this cinema in Cape Town, you know you get like salt or sweet.
Yeah.
All the popcorn is plain, but then you get given these sachets of seasoning to pour on it.
Ugh.
And Talia, like, we were hungry. Talia was like, I want popcorn. She really likes popcorn. I was like, okay. And she chose this butter-flavored seasoning. And I thought, oh, like...
Butter seasoning?
Butter salt. And, you know, something in my mind was like, oh, yeah, like, butter popcorn, like, could be quite nice. She dusted that stuff on and she audibly went like,
oh no.
And then like I tried, she was like, the popcorn's really bad. And then I tried it and I was like, oh, just this new sensation that just like I'd never really tasted. It tasted like UPF processed dust. Just foul. Anyway, so I'm associating the film with this terrible popcorn. Anyway, anyone but you. I think it's really hard. I do kind of feel bad for a film right now that is a rom-com, that is really like going all out, going on the big screen, because it gets so much attention of like, oh really, a rom-com in cinemas, released with big stars. Mm. And then it gets this like almost unfair hyper-magnifying glass on it, whereas like, has it saved the rom-com? Mm. Is it funny? Is it a commentary on our society and love in a way that's refreshing and represents everyone and is new and is it smart but also going to make you cry?
It's like every rom-com now is a referendum on the rom-com.
Totally. And I think in a lot of ways that's really unfair. And Anyone But You is a film starring Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney, two of the sexiest people in Hollywood right now. I think I'm definitely getting a crush on Glenn Powell.
He is, it's happening. Smooth, isn't he?
He's having a really good year. Like Hitman is where the crush, I think, you know, solidified.
This is a really random thing to say, but you'd fancy Glenn Powell if he was your waiter.
Mm.
You know, can you imagine him being like, "Hey, ladies, can I get you anything today?"
And
you'd be like, "What?"
And he's actually also like, he teaches surfing lessons like down the beach.
Yeah.
Mm. And so, you know, like Top Gun Maverick, I see you, Glenn Powell. I see the volleyball scene or the football scene. I'm like, hey. And then Hitman, I'm like, completely, this guy's great. Sure. What a range. He's not just like a sort of...
you've got us all on tenterhooks for Hitman.
Frat boy. And then I see him in this movie and he's... And Sydney Sweeney already, you know, already, I'm already there with Sydney Sweeney.
Of course.
Yeah. Anyway, it's really hard to do a rom-com. It's directed by Will Gluck, who also did Friends with Benefits.
Yes.
Remember that film?
And Easy A.
And Easy A, I think Friends with Benefits is mixed, but I remember enjoying it at the time. I can't say I've seen it.
Better than No Strings Attached. Which
I thought that too. I really thought that too. And Talia was like, no Strings Attached is better. And I was like, I think Friends with Benefits is better. We then watched them. Friends with Benefits is better.
No. You mean...
Sorry. No Strings Attached is better. The Ashton Kutcher...
So the 2011 Friends with Benefits themed movie starring a Black Swan star.
Yeah.
The best one is the Natalie Portman one.
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
I did promise you I watched these back to back and I was like, damn it, Talia's right.
Okay.
Sydney Sweeney and Glenn Powell, you know, they cast the sexiest people in Hollywood. When I saw the trailer, I thought this is pitching itself as a really sexy, smoldering, intense rom-com, very enticing. I thought, you know what? I was quite excited to go and see a rom-com in cinema.
If I may, a feature-length thirst trap.
Totally. It's a swimsuit ad, completely. Mm. And George, They cast them. They get them naked as often as they can. Anytime they get, there are so many. All the clothes have come off. Gags, like literally, Glenn Powell, so many times is just cupping his crotch, running across the screen. Brilliant. And it's a delight. Like, very low stakes to go and see a rom-com, and I'm just quite happy to go and see it. And I did have a good time watching it. Anyway, so I have this opening scene, meet cute. Sydney Sweeney rushes into a cafe. She's desperate to use the toilet, but the cafe's got a long line going all the way down the cafe. And she's like, hi, please, I'm going to buy something. Please, can I have a bathroom key? And the person behind the counter is like, hi, I'm so sorry. I can only give the bathroom key to people who've bought something. And she's like, but the queue is so long. Literally, I'm going to buy something, blah, blah, blah. And she's literally about to pee her pants. And who is sit already at the front of the queue? It's Glenn Powell, who says, who just jumps in and says, honey, sweetie, how about I get you your peppermint tea? And he sort of pretends to be in a relationship with her to help her out. And she's like, oh, yeah, thank you. That would be great. And he's like, oh, and I'll give you the bathroom key. So he sort of sees a woman in distress and sort of says, oh, you know what? I'll pretend to be your partner. Gives her the bathroom key. Sydney Sweeney goes into the bathroom and has this sort of comedy where she actually like splashes her crotch with water and looks like she's peed her pants. And then she's waiting a long time. Anyway, they come out.
Hilarity ensues.
Hilarity ensues. They come out and they have this lovely little like walk and talk, and they end up spending the night together at Glenn Powell's flat, and they sleep together, and it's like really sort of cute, and they're having this like, you know, real chemistry. And Sydney Sweeney is just sort of on a break from a relationship, and she's very confused when she wakes up in the morning, and she decides, you know what, just not complicate things, I'm just going to leave without saying goodbye. And Glenn Powell sort of notices her leaving and is a little bit like, you know, upset by the fact that she's just left without sort of saying anything. Sydney Sweeney calls her friend to be like, yeah, I just like slept with this guy and it's so this and that. And Glenn Powell's like, she just left, and his roommate comes in and he ends up saying something. His friend then pushes him to be like, why did you let her leave? And he ends up like in a way of bravado to his friend being like, oh God, she's nothing to me. Meanwhile, Sydney Sweeney was like, I'm just going to go back and say hi. And as she comes back, overhears him saying like, she's nothing to me, blah, blah, blah. What they don't realize is actually a year later, they have a very close mutual friend.
Right.
And so of course, what happens is those friends are getting married and they're going to Australia. Both of them are invited.
Destination wedding, there we go.
You got that classic Australia, bright, sunny escapism, destination wedding, but they can't stand each other. They literally hate each other's guts. And everyone's aware of the fact that they don't like each other, and everyone else thinks it's a good idea to try and set them up.
Classic.
Which to them, and they were aware that everyone's trying to set them up, and they have this chat at one point. They're like, look, everyone's trying to set us up. This is really annoying. Why don't we just pretend like we're getting on and we're together, and that will shut everyone up. And so therefore they have to pretend like they're
a contrivance upon contrivance. Okay.
Like they're together. And that's where sort of the comedy happens. So here's the thing. I actually laughed quite a bit. I had a good chuckle like consistently throughout at some of the gags. And as I said, like a lot of the humor, and I remember criticizing No Hard Feelings for this, of like the funniest thing you can do is just get your person naked. Mm. Is that the funniest gag? That is the funniest gag here a lot of the time. What I got from this film was a real sense of like hollowness. And I mean that both in terms of like some of the line delivery, but literally the film felt hollow. So it's this wedding in Sydney and no one's there. I really got the sense that like there are no extras and nobody's actually really here. Huh. And they hired an Airbnb in Australia with a beachfront property, and they just filmed scenes in this Airbnb with the cast. Huh. Like, it's really hard to explain this feeling of like they just hired this spot shot there.
There's no contextual shots of wider extras. Like,
no. Oh, wow. Like, it's a wedding. Usually there are people and like there's more activity. People around. There's like maybe 8 people in the cast. And there's just no sense of like, this is actually happening and here's where we are. I got a sense you had a budget for stars.
Yeah.
And you bought an Airbnb and you shot around the garden.
You blew it all on Australia and the stars.
You had to fly Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney first class to Australia.
It's the same Airbnb which the crew are actually staying to make the movie.
100%. 100%. And the director were just like, yeah, we'll all stay there because it's lovely.
They looked at the
combination
budget.
And location budget just got merged.
They looked at the budget and they got 1 0 wrong. They actually put one too many zeros on the thing.
And then, like, you know, you eventually get a wide of a wedding and there's like, I just thinking, that's the sound guy's brother. that's the director's cousin. Like, I just don't believe that there was a wedding. So I get this sort of hollow sense of the film. And it's got such a sheeny exterior.
Yeah.
But I like a really old car that's been done up. The gear changes of the plot clunky. And we go from this scene to this scene. There's one dynamic that the film leans on so heavily, which is characters are overhearing, like in the very first meet cute, they're overhearing conversations. And the film has this joke where it wants the other characters to know that person's overhearing to try and get them to think something. And at first it's funny, but it becomes the only way that the film chooses to let characters learn information.
Wow.
And I just think this is really lazy. You're literally just in the Airbnb at different parts of the garden, trying to get as many angles of like, oh, they're over the hedge and he's here and he's listening. I'm like, is that the only idea we've got to bring information to characters when that was the first thing in the meet cute? I just found that a little bit like boring and lazy as it went on. You know, it's weird. I know this isn't relevant or fair because they're completely different films, but I did watch Annie Hall properly for the first time in the same period. And I it's problematic in some ways, Annie Hall, and Woody Allen's not exactly the most favourable person to be like looking at in this day and age. But something about that dialogue is like so smart and sharp and you just want to listen to it. Some of the dialogue in this is just a little bit waffly, and sometimes people are talking and they just fade in music. Like, you can't be asked to finish the dialogue in your scene. And I just think that's a shame. And then watching Annie Hall within like the same week as that, to me, just like really screamed the difference. Again, I know completely different films trying to do very different things, but you just long for sharper dialogue. Mm. Like I said, a sheeny exterior with a very clunky interior shifting through.
Could I ask something as well? Is that when you described it as a sexy rom-com, I kind of was interested, not because I'm some sort of base man, but because there's been a problem with films for a long time becoming kind of sexless, and in a way that they weren't in the past. Films were much more willing to engage with sex as a topic, as a conversation in the past, and be a bit more risque. And over the past 20 years, sex has kind of waned off, whereas violence has stayed. And it's this weird thing where, like, you take a film like The Hunger Games, which is like the dynamics of the relationship are very sexless, but the violence remains. It's almost like parents are happy because they can see violence and it's easier. It's more black and white to say violence is bad. Whereas sex is more complicated. Anyway,
culturally, sex between across the Atlantic.
Yeah, sure. So when this rom comes along and it says it looks like a sexy rom com, does it actually dip it, like, get itself mucky and be dirty? And is it sexy?
There is sex. It is sexy. I don't know if it necessarily is about sex, and
it's not sexually progressive or anything like that. Is it sexually empowering? Sexually liberating? Sexual agency? Is it anything?
Nothing of note.
It's not really interested in a conversation.
It's not about sex. It's about it's about the two characters. It's a nice sex scene in there. It's hot. I liked it. It's like an underwear ad. Like, you know, the two beautiful people. You got their clothes off quite a lot.
I see. But it's hard because I don't usually find films like sexy. But like I have talked about this before. But in like Out of Sight with George Clooney and George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez, they have palpable, really good sexual tension, sexual chemistry, and it's really like engaging. I'm like, is that here?
I can't, nothing of note to say here. I think I sort of almost when I feel like I'm talking about a film like this, people want to say, is it back? Is rom-com back? And it's not fair to go just because this film decided to put itself out in cinema to be the arbiter of whether or not rom-coms are saved and rom-coms are back. So I'm glad it's there.
Right.
And I enjoyed the low stakes entry of going to see a rom-com in a cinema where it's like, I'm just going to have fun with my partner on a sunny winter and just enjoy it. But it's okay. A little bit disappointing. It is kind of funny.
How long is it?
I can't remember. Maybe just over 90 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it's a tight 90, then
it's not too long. Okay. It never felt long. It's fun. It's cute. It's not amazing. Could have done with some much better dialogue.
Isn't that true of any films and any rom-com?
Yeah.
If you've seen Anyone But You and would like to send us your thoughts, email in to hello@pulpkitchenpodcast.com.
I'd really love it if someone can articulate this feeling better of like that hollow, I see the production have hired a place. Maybe it's because I work in media and I could see that, but I really felt that. And I know, like Wedding Crashers.
Right.
So you've seen it?
Yeah. A long time ago.
I really believed the weddings that they went to were happening and like all the people around.
Genuine weddings, yeah.
Genuine weddings. And like, yes, like that person's there. Maybe it's a budget thing to do with extras and the budget. Maybe all budget goes on the cast and that, I don't know. Mm. But I really got a sense of legitimate things are happening around the characters.
If someone said to you that movie was made in COVID, would you believe it?
Oh, totally.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Totally. Huh. I don't think it was. But
no, it wasn't.
You can really see it. Glenn Powell, though, he's a big star.
I like, you know, Sydney Sweeney was in Reality last year, which we both really liked. You know, and she's a talent. So
also, I keep going on about it. I've just seen Glenn Powell in Hitman, and he does so many different better things. He's brilliant in it. It's his breakout role for me. Mm. And then I see him in this, and he's not bad, but I'm like, I know you've got so much more going on. I know you can do so much more going on. Mm. But anyway, that's anyone but you. Let me know your thoughts.
So let's do Ferrari, a new film by Michael Mann, who hasn't made a movie in about 10 years. Last movie he made was Black Hat with Chris Hemsworth, which was this sort of hacking thriller that absolutely bombed and went nowhere. It's one of those forgotten films. I don't see it ever on a streaming platform carousel.
Yeah, so it doesn't have a home.
No, Michael Mann, his most famous film is definitely Heat, which is an absolutely sublime film. Fantastic movie. I think he also made Last of the Mohicans as well. But Heat is fantastic.
Collateral.
He did make Collateral, that's right. Yeah, he's best known for these sort of crime LA thrillers with a kind of conflicted look, moral conflict in a sort of male lead.
Yeah, men in the pursuit of something extraordinary and great at the sacrifice of the personal.
Yes, men gazing out of a big window out of the city and sort of feeling conflicted.
I must conquer it.
While their wife tells them that they need to get on with like doing more important things, and they're like, shh, 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 shh. It's one of those kind of like,
I will deal with you.
It's a bit
thusly.
It's a bit male ego-y, but it's there.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's back with Ferrari, which is a biopic of Enzo Ferrari, co-founder of Ferrari, as we know it now, the brand. This movie predominantly takes place in 1957. It follows Enzo Ferrari, who is a former racing driver from the 20s, who set up Ferrari with his wife, played by Penelope Cruz, in the ruins of post-war Italy. And they're based in Modena, famous for its balsamic vinegar.
That's what we know it from, at least.
And he has a struggling car production factory, but his passion is racing. And there's a line in it where he says, Maserati races to sell sports cars. Mm. I sell cars so I can race. He doesn't race himself, but, you know, so he can participate in racing. That's his true passion. We find him in 1957 in this sort of weird zone where he's looking at a lot of kind of metaphorical deaths. There's the death of his marriage. He's in a sort of barren relationship with Penelope Cruz, and actually is in this relationship with Shailene Woodley in a sort of who's sequestered in this villa outside of Modena with whom he has a child. He's dealing with the loss of his son with Penelope Cruz a few years prior. His brother died in the First World War. He's got this sort of stasis about him, but his passion is racing. And Adam Driver plays Ferrari who's in a very sort of cold, taciturn, ruthlessness, I'd say. It's about 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And it follows, the main thrust is following his relationship dynamics between Penelope Cruz and Shailene Woodley and trying to find a way of saving his struggling Ferrari company by entering what's called the Mille Miglia, which is this Italian named race in 1957. James, give us your thoughts.
You know, there's things that I found, the film dipped its toes in that I thought was interesting. Yeah. Like, first of all, I think like the study of the man, I think it's somewhat interesting. I think Adam Driver's always great in everything he's done. I think, you know, I think he's had a bit of a rough run coming from House of Gucci, 65. Mm. And I don't think Ferrari is like, you know, a home run necessarily. But he's always an actor I'm really interested in. And when I saw the trailer for this, I thought, I fancy that. I love how much of a physical presence Ferrari was. He's the biggest man in the room, both in stature and in status. He's got these big suits with broad lapels and he talks very, very convincingly. And I enjoyed this little, I don't think they did it enough, but talking about the motoring industry post-World War II, there was a little bit of a boom once there was peace, but obviously like things becoming consolidated, might be acquired by Henry Ford or Fiat.
Yeah.
For motorists out there, which I'm not, motorist fans out there, I think there's a little bit to be enjoyed there. I think there's something nice to be said about he views everything through these large sunglasses and there's a faint red tint to the glasses, very much like the red of the Ferrari, like the red of blood, sort of things there, like the haunting of something terrible could happen. I think ultimately the film really lacks focus. Mm. And there's only maybe two or three moments in the film where it all stopped being a bunch of noise and it snapped into focus for me. And I all of a sudden became interested. But outside of that, I was a little bit bored. Mm. I felt like a lot of the things we just mentioned about Michael Mann films, feeling like one man trying to do something, and the female characters in this film being lost in a role, which I don't think is that interesting or new. I don't think this film, I think this film is one of those, unfortunately. I think, you know, there's one thing that this film didn't do very well, which I think films like Top Gun Maverick did very well, and even Gran Turismo did very well, which is really clearly communicate what the race is or the trial is, why it's important, what we have to do, and what happens if we win or we lose. Yeah. I could have really done with, okay, so the race, I know you sort of need to win to save the thing of Ferrari, but like, what? Who's the person and why are we here and what are we doing? Yes. And it's just a couple of moments. If you've seen the film, you know the moments I mean, where it really snaps into focus. It's a great moment where Adam Driver is talking about to this new class of racers who are going to race Ferraris, and he talks about there can only be two cars that cannot occupy the same space. I thought that was interesting. Other than that, a bit of a slog, a little bit boring, not noise, a little bit of noise.
I agree with you totally. I must say the first third, even the first half of the film, I really struggled with. In the first 20 minutes, I thought, oh, I can't believe I have to sit through 2 hours of this. It was incredibly unfocused, all over, hither and dither with ideas. It's a really messy script, I think. Yeah. And I have to say, it's one of the clunkiest edited films I've seen in a long time, both in terms of narrative structure, cutting away from a scene mid-action to then to another scene to then cut back. I was always aware of this kind of cutting, and I thought it was really intrusive. And literally also there are cuts mid-scene, mid-dialogue, and to cuts that don't match up. It's one of those...
I know where to follow.
Yeah, I'm not an editor, but... as an audience member, I shouldn't be aware of the images changing in front of me because then I'm aware of the mechanics in cinema.
Just bad editing, right?
Well, exactly. Yeah. So I thought that was really, really clunky. I think it gets just lost in trying to do this sort of love triangle dynamic between Shailene Woodley and Penelope Cruz. I think Penelope Cruz is the best thing in the film, actually.
Yeah.
She's really good. She's committed. She's full of conviction in her role. I mean, Adam Driver is solid, but actually every time Penelope Cruz was on, I was like, yeah, you're doing the best with a fairly limited role.
I think like you and me explaining the film just now is doing a lot of the work that the film doesn't do.
Yes.
I actually think watching the film, I didn't have a clear idea of like who it's about and what the dynamic is until very late in the film and when I left.
Yes.
I actually think us talking about this is what it's about and you've got this triangle and this mistress and the son and the name... That isn't screaming at you clear in the beginning.
No.
And I just on accents, obviously the accent the black hole Jared Leto accent that he left in House of Gucci sucks in all accents within it. There's no comparing. I do get the sense that I don't dislike the accents themselves, but sometimes I feel like I'm listening to Italians speak their second language.
Yes. Yeah, so it's, we should explain. Quite, yeah. So this is not like... a Napoleon or something where every actor keeps their original accent.
No.
This is Adam Driver talking like this. It is Shailene Woodley really struggling with an Italian accent to basically be American but with a slight Italian accent.
It's tricky.
And you're right, you have otherwise Italian actors. I mean, obviously Penelope Cruz is not Italian, but speaking in English, as you said, like a second language. Yeah.
Yeah. And then so I get this thing, even though they're pronouncing things like Modena and Enzo Ferrari. Yes, like someone speaking their second language. So therefore is the dialogue as clear as it should be when you're telling the story, and the script in itself is just a little bit fluffy.
I find it
give
also...
Give me focus.
Yeah, and also I just find it a bit patronising when you have someone, Adam Driver, needing to do, oh, I'm speaking in Italian. Like I could have got a full sense of who Enzo Ferrari was as a person if you'd done your normal accent.
Frustratingly, I think Ferrari was in... The character Ferrari was in a very similar position at the beginning of the film as he was at the end, despite the events occurring.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean...
And the ending for me, the last scene, I was like... Oh, and we're done.
Oh, yeah, that's the end. Right, that's the end.
We're done. A couple of splash screens.
There is some, almost immediately, some very misjudged use of CGI in this film. I think... this is a massive sweeping statement, but I kind of thought it was a little bit evident of a director who hasn't made a film in a while coming back. And I felt like going, oh, Michael, that's not how we haven't done it like that for ages. You don't need to use that quality CGI, not very good quality, in that moment to communicate that thing. You could have done and made that moment could have been just as shocking without messing with the CGI button.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
And
there's two moments in particular that are really,
Yeah. And, yes, anyway, but I would say that
the first third, I really struggled. It kind of stabilizes a bit in the second. But the third act, which is really when it focuses about the race,
yeah,
gives its purpose, gives it meaning.
A little bit, though.
I mean, a little bit, yeah. But I must say, I because of the period, what I did like is that it wasn't... it didn't do a House of Gucci and it was like, everything is Italian. It was low-key stylish.
Yeah.
Everyone was stylish.
Very chic,
but it's really quite beige and brown because it's the 50s. But then when you get this like bold, iconic red of the Ferrari and the vintage cars racing through, really well kind of shot racing scenes, I was like, oh, I do find myself kind of lusting over that nicely. And that bold red does cut through that
Patrick
beige.
Dempsey and Jack O'Connell with fantastic white eyes and then just black soot black all over their face and neck.
Ridiculous hair, you know, coloured hair.
I think
that's it. I think so. Penelope Cruz is brilliant. Adam Driver is solid. The racing scenes really give it focus, but it really is quite dull. And there it hints at things every so often, like Ferrari has a conversation with his son about how an engine works and his approach to design and his belief that form kind of leads function. You know, there's this stereotype that Italian cars look beautiful, but they don't race very well. And like German cars, the opposite. Okay.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, I'm not a motorsports follower, but that's the cliche. I like this idea that about him leading with form over function, that he says in it, like, my belief is that if something looks beautiful, it will then work beautifully. Mm. And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting idea about the design of a car and your aesthetic approach to motoring. But that is never returned to again.
Yeah.
I also will concede that I don't find motorsport particularly interesting. I love the racing scenes, but a bit like I found with Ford v Ferrari, I liked the racing scenes in that, and everything else I found really dull.
Yeah.
So
I saw it with my mum and dad and Talia.
Oh, yeah.
And they very bored. Came out, didn't really know what it was about, not because of weren't listening, just because it doesn't give you a lot of clarity of what it's about. Very boring.
And it's quite immediate, I found. Immediately I was like, oh, this is all over the place, sort of stop start, which is really disappointing.
And Adam Driver's really good, as always. And he gives such an intensity and I think really does the best of what he's given.
And also Michael Mann has announced, I don't know if he's announced or he's heavily rumoured to be doing a prequel to Heat, with Adam Driver playing Robert De Niro's character. And I really do feel like... I don't want that, Michael. You made a great film nearly 30 years ago. Can you make an original film?
Yeah.
But also, this isn't the return from Michael Mann I think we wanted.
I also would have enjoyed, as both of us non-motorist enthusiasts, a bit more about that period and cars and history. I think I'm quite receptive to learn more about that dynamic and who is going to acquire who, this post-war
the state of Italy,
consolidation, really how do you do manufacturing, you want to race but you actually need to get commercial cars out.
This is what I found really clunky. So it begins with this black and white footage of Enzo Ferrari in the 20s racing, which was kind of interesting. Okay. And then it just so clunky, it just throws text on the screen and says, Enzo Ferrari set up this company in 19 so-and-so with his wife.
Yeah.
He was a racing driver. Now he runs this company. And then you just arrive in 1957. And I'm like, why couldn't you it's so lazy.
There.
Can you not have shown me? Because I'm sitting there watching Enzo Ferrari, the character, from then onwards, and I'm thinking, but I've missed all the stuff that makes you who you are. I've missed the formation of Ferrari as a company. There are flashbacks, fleeting flashbacks to the kind of the state the company and Italy was in post war, and his relationship with his son who then died. And I'm thinking, that's
given his story,
give me that.
The dynamic with the mistress from post war Italy, like feels like we've picked up on that late in Act Two of the story of Enzo Ferrari, and you called the film Ferrari. It's not the Mille Miglia dynamic with Ferrari in it.
Mille Miglia,
and we've picked up with Ferrari. It's like very much the last part of his story, if that. Again, I don't really know. So a little bit
pretty lackluster,
noisy, fluffy,
yes,
lacking focus.
I will say this. I'm going to talk about this in unspoiler terms. There is a moment. There is a very pivotal, shocking moment that happens in the fourth act or whatever. You know. And you're shown the sort of aftermath of that moment. And my friend said that we were talking about the sort of the poor CGI and stuff. And my friend said, when he saw it at the cinema, when they showed the aftermath, bits of the aftermath, he couldn't help in the cinema but burst out laughing, and he said everyone in the room looked at me like I was a serial killer because they were like, why are you laughing at this thing? That's not good. Anyway, if you've seen Ferrari, let us know your thoughts to James
hello @popkitchenpodcast.com. when you have the events that the film sort of leads to towards, yeah. at the moment in the end, which is what happens, you almost want, okay, we've had a very cold character who doesn't want to engage in a certain way. He's very focused in one lane of his life. I almost wanted that to be like a shocking moment for the audience and a shocking moment for Enzo. Bring it round to something, and I just don't think it did.
Yeah, or
so you're left feeling like, oh, and then it's over, I guess. We're done.
Yes. No, you're right. Yeah,
that's such a moment for me where you try and cling on to something of who this man is and what really makes him tick.
Or you reveal that he is completely cold.
Yes.
But they didn't really do that either. It sort of just cuts to him and Penelope Cruz in a conversation. And anyway, that was Ferrari. I think it's not... I don't really think it's going to get much buzz.
It's out in a very crowded end of year period.
It's absolutely bombed as well.
Has it?
I think in box office terms, yeah. Mm.
It's not a good time to release it. It's the end of the year. I don't know if there's a lot of other things out which have interest for people. Shame. Well, I guess it's not that good.
Anyway, that was Ferrari.
Right, George, should we go through some of the emails that we get sent every single week? Guys, thank you for sending in so many over the New Year Christmas period. Yeah. All of you sent your emails in, of course, to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. Just like Sam did, friend of the show. Sam writes into the show and he says, hello, lads. It's Sam, delivery driver. Yeah, but he says deliver driver. Maybe he delivers.
Liver. It's deliver driver.
From Guernsey here to talk about my favourite films I've watched this year. In total, I've watched 143 films this year, 106 of them being for the first time.
Oh, okay. So, I see. Still good.
Still good numbers, Sam. Good numbers.
Good on you.
My top five are, brackets, not all new releases from this year.
So his top five new discoveries, basically.
New discoveries. Go. Honourable mention to The Holdovers, brackets, Cried.
Yes, not seen it yet.
We are going to hopefully see it really soon. Looking forward to that. I worked the premiere. That's all I'll say. Five, After Sun, Cried. 4, Little Women, Cried. 3, There Will Be Blood, Cried.
Really?
2, Killers of the Flower Moon, Cried. 1, Life is Beautiful, Cried. Sam, are you okay?
Yeah.
This isn't about movies, is it?
But a lot of those are emotional, but There Will Be Blood.
Woke up this morning, cried. In the shower, cried. I think I've learned, Sam goes on to say, I think I've learned this year that I like really sad films or films that make me feel any kind of emotion. There Will Be Blood, Cry is an interesting one.
Maybe the relationship with the son.
Yeah.
That's particularly painful, perhaps.
I wasn't sad when I watched it. I was more, by that point in the film, especially.
It's not a film I would call emotional.
Mm. Killers of the Flower Moon. No, I don't think I was there. I was so many other things. I don't think I cried.
No.
Hope you're all right, Sam. Life is Beautiful, the best favourite film of this year, made me cry so much. It was borderline embarrassing for the last few lines.
That's a real weepy one.
And I was sobbing for at least an hour, but an incredible film. Keep up the good work. I love this pod so much. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Sam,
very much.
You look after yourself, man.
Yeah, take it well. Stay happy for 2024. Yeah. This next email is from Honey. Honey says, hello, George and James, in brackets, James and George. I'm a long-time listener, but I've never sent an email in before. So hello.
Hello, Honey.
Am I too late to the Saltburn discussion? Mm. I just watched it. It has now been added to Amazon Prime. And wow, I loved it. Mm. I totally understand both of your guys' opinions and viewpoints about the films. However, this film was just made for me. I absolutely loved all the performances. Barry Keoghan, you creepy effer. I'm just going to censor that word. I don't know why. We sometimes swear, but I'm just going to do it. And the soundtrack was so nostalgic. However,
in all caps,
I had seen this film going pretty viral for its disturbing scenes, with people on TikTok and Twitter going mental over the scene and the scene and the scene. If you know, you know. Going into this film, I expected some really graphic and disturbing stuff that would shock me. However, I found it pretty tame, weird, but not disturbing or shocking and gross. It made me realize how...
That's what we said.
That's a really interesting point, actually. I'm going to stop on that one, but because it's weird, but it's not disturbing because it's not tied to anything psychologically deeper, I don't think.
No.
Those things that you see are not disturbing.
And the scene later...
Yeah.
Where, you know, like, not the end, but near the end, that scene is held for so long.
Yeah.
Whereas I never found it that shocking to see, but it's held for such a long time
that
you're forced to confront it.
Yeah, and also because the longer that shot is held, the more I feel the presence of Emerald Fennell being like, look at this, hey?
Yeah.
Look how weird this is. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. Thank you. Honey goes on to say, it made me realize how casual film viewers probably don't expose themselves to weird shit very often, as I have seen hundreds of films with more weird and disturbing content than Saltburn. I find that foreign cinema, particularly European, includes a lot more bizarre scenes like this one, as I mentioned. So I suppose I have become a little desensitized. I'd love to know what you guys thought surrounding the disturbing hype. But like I said, absolutely love the film and cannot wait to rewatch it already. From Honey.
P.S. I met George in a lift once at a Martin Scorsese event. He was very nice, much taller than I imagined. Yes, honey, I remember that. Hello. How are you doing? Saltburn.
A lot of people are saying they really enjoy it.
Well, look,
anecdotally, and then from the listeners.
I think Honey has picked up on something. Yes, we have had listeners email in who saw it at the cinema and really liked it. Mm-hmm. What I think Honey is finding is that it went on to Amazon Prime just before Christmas, and then loads of people then watched it. I think people who never would have watched it before and threw it on casually and were then kind of sort of enjoyed it in a kind of like a titillating way.
Yeah.
People who never watch, as Honey sort of says, a film of that kind of nature. So they see these shocking scenes and they go, oh my God, it's so shocking. Mm. And they immediately go to Twitter and TikTok and make a thing out of it. And it's become like a meme now of like, oh, watching Saltburn with my parents. Mm. But I agree that I just think it's bullshit. I'm sorry. I don't think it's bad. Don't get me wrong. I superficially enjoyed it, but I do think, but in the real like last third, I really got kind of tired of that. I think it's bullshit because I've heard Emerald Fennell like talk about certain elements of it. And I'm like, that's really interesting when you talk about it, but that's just not coming through in the film. And I think sometimes would this film have been better if it just tried to be a comedy? A black comedy,
sure.
But if it just tried to be, instead
Which
of trying
try to,
be
a lot of time.
It has funny moments and stuff. But I'm almost like, why didn't you just go for embrace the silliness of this, the dark silliness, and make it like the campness of it, and make it a comedy? But sometimes I find like it wants to also be like a prestigious satirization of like the wealth, which is just not there.
It kind of reveals to you in terms of its. Like what's actually going on, the less interesting it becomes, and the point in the very end where it tells you exactly what's going on. I'm like, that's where I completely lost interest and I was done.
I just think that, sometimes the film wants to, in trying to always try and make a serious coded point about something, it gets in the way of actually being as fun as its silliness and its campness would actually let it to be. There are just some moments I think, oh, this would be so much more fun and enjoyable if you weren't trying to get me to invest in this in a kind of a deeper level. Mm. I don't know. I don't think it's terrible. I prefer it to Promising Young Women, and I do think there's stuff in there I like. It's gorgeous, absolutely
beautiful,
gorgeous to look at, and it's got some moments that did make me chuckle. But I'm not convinced.
I texted you yesterday. I was like 90% sure. I was right next to Emerald Fennell on the tube.
Oh, yeah.
I was standing, very busy tube, standing like next to her at the time, but she was facing the other way. And then a seat came free. So I took a seat and I look up and I'm like really sure it's Emerald Fennell. She's not a face I have like obviously very well, you know, dialed in, but you know, I was like pretty sure. And then like with the Wi-Fi at the next station, I Googled Emerald Fennell to literally cross-reference her face with the thing. And I was like, oh, I'm like 95% sure that's her.
Look, and if she was sat across me right now, I absolutely believe, because she seems like a really charming, engaged person, like she would be able to convince me and speak passionately about the film. And I she spoke about one point where she was like, oh, the film is really about power. And that's like, explains the vampire scene between Barry Keoghan and the daughter. And he's, you know, Barry Keoghan's, Oliver's the character, is very tuned into how to give power to people and where they need it. And I'm like, that's a really interesting
and the dynamic between, what's the guy's name? Archie
Farley. Farley. If, the name character.
Yes.
Character,
yeah.
Character
yeah. Farley. That dynamic and like how power through wealth and opportunity.
And I think that's
that was more interesting
but,
to me.
But I'm just like, I don't know if it's actually that sharp in the film, but anyway, I digress. I'm pretty mixed on it, but if people like it, that's cool. It's enjoy it. It might as well.
This next one's from Zuzana, who says, "Dear James and George, I hope you're doing well and having a lovely and cozy December. Greetings from Krakow, Poland."
So we are reading this later.
The font that you've used is like, I think it's Garamond.
Oh, let's have a look.
And it's kind of like Dumbledore's handwriting when he writes to Harry to say, "You've got a place at Hogwarts. Enjoy it." As we are now in this end of year kind of magical time, I would like to take this moment to thank you both for the amazing, interesting and entertaining content that you have been creating and sharing at this podcast. I hope you know how much joy you've been bringing to your listeners. I also appreciate how, in a good way, you've changed the way I look at films now. I'm always curious what you have to say, and if possible, I enjoy listening to the general review before watching and then spoiler-free afterwards.
Thank you very
That's
much.
Why we do them.
That's great.
I have a couple of friends that I love discussing movies with, and I keep sharing bits and pieces of your podcast with them, mostly to discuss films, but also to spread the iconic moments such as, "Why would anyone want to lick your teeth?" mystery is finally solved. I'll have my braces taken off in January and I really don't know what to expect. Get someone to lick your teeth. George will probably know the people who would do it.
What can I say? It just happened. As far as
the previous episode for details.
Oh yeah, that was great.
Many episodes.
Well, yeah, well, quite a while now. As far as this Christmas time movies are concerned, I'm starting off with the screening of Aquaman: The Lost Kingdom. My expectations are so low that I may actually enjoy it. That film has happened. we're not.
It is a link on a Wikipedia page somewhere. You know, it's like it's a historical fact.
Some contractual obligation.
It happened. Yeah, that sound you hear is the existence of Aquaman 2.
Don't check your phone. The podcast is still going.
Yeah.
We're just not...
There it is.
I don't... If you guys was like, oh my God, please, James, there's something really interesting going on, or it would be worth... You know what's the thing about DC films now? Is that, if I'm to be really cynical, if I'm watching bad Marvel films, there's some value to see what's happening, to engage with this conversation of superhero films as a whole, and to cover maybe Marvel losing its touch. That has an interest to me. Weirdly, DC has been so unraveled and spineless and structureless for so long. I'm not just going to see a film that I don't think is very good or isn't interesting to me just to comment on something that I already know
it's
the dynamic.
Empty calories.
Yeah, totally. Sorry. All-time favorite Christmas movie of mine is Home Alone, which apparently is quite popular in Poland. Every year it's broadcast by the same channel, but when one time they decided not to do it, people protested so heavily that they brought it back. Nice. At the time, streaming services were not that big yet. That's when I realized it's not just me who loves it so much. Not to make this long email any longer, thank you again and happy holidays to you and your families. Take care, Zuza. When you say protest, were there like riots outside the...
We want Culkin. Yeah. Oh, very interesting. Thank you. This next email is from Leonora, who says, hi, James and George. Greetings from Germany and happy holidays. What a tour of Europe we're doing today,
love
James. It's fun. I've recently discovered your podcast and I enjoy it quite a lot.
Nice.
Thank you for the discussion on Napoleon. Yes, we reviewed that back in November. Quite a few people have come, you know, seen it since, getting sort of mixed reviews.
A lot of people ask me, like, is Napoleon any good? How's Napoleon?
I very much agree with your assessment of the film and that it fell flat. What irks me the most, though, was the treatment of time. I didn't mind Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon per se, but I found it confusing that he never seemed to age, nor fitted the age of Napoleon properly. At one point, quite long into the film, he said something about the lines of, she has been with me for the past 12 years, referencing his first wife, and only then I realized how much time has passed, as Phoenix didn't seem to age at all. More so, afterwards, I found out that Napoleon was in his early 20s when the film started, but looked like he was in his 40s. And only in the last scenes, they actually seemed to show that time had passed at all.
It's not a historical film.
It's not accurate at all. I discovered that Josephine was actually 6 years older than him, which wasn't addressed or indicated. Yeah, this film does not
Which you think, considering the whole, can you bear my child thing, might have been interesting, but it's not.
The lack of attention to detail from Scott's side quite frustrated me, and I'm glad to see I'm not the only one who thought so. Now, a question I would like to ask you. I also recently listened to an older episode where you discussed women talking. Mm. And it got me thinking. I watched the film after reading the book, Women Talking, twice, and during a time when I was writing my MA thesis about the novel. Therefore, I was very familiar with the source material, which impacted the way I saw and thought about the film. In brackets, I liked it a lot, but there are some minor shortcomings, in my opinion. So my question would be, in your critical assessment of films, do you consider the source material or context, novels, adaptations of plays, musicals, reboots, prequels and sequels, such as in the case of Wonka, etc., in relation to the new film? Would you find it important that it's, e.g., true to its source or brings something new to an existing story or anything like that? Or do you hardly pay further attention to the relationship between a film and its source materials? Sorry for the long email. Thank you for the great podcast. I really enjoy it. And I can't wait for when Oscar season is upon us. Best wishes, Leonora.
We kind of touched upon this a couple of months ago, maybe.
I would say that, yeah, we talked about before about like adapting and adapting your source text. What I will say is first and foremost, I don't know about you, James, but I always like to believe that a film
should just
kind of work on its own terms. So whether or not it's adapted from a book, whether or not it's based, whether or not it's a prequel, whether or not it's a reboot, whatever, does it work for its audience, for you? And and also, does it work for kind of a new audience or for the audience that's in front of it? So I don't like it when you go and see a film and based on a pre-existing text and the film doesn't work. People say, oh, that's because you don't know the existing text.
Game of Thrones.
Whenever we criticize Marvel stuff, people have gone, oh yeah, but that's how it is in the comics. I'm like, I don't care, because we're a movie audience.
This is different.
And we're paying to see a film right in front of us. So I'm always of the opinion that a film should work in and of itself. I know films don't exist in a vacuum, but it has to. It can't rest on its source material
and get
can't some, assume you know
get
the
out
blanks,
of loopholes. Yeah, kind of
story. Exactly. There's also like, I totally agree with you, but then you've got to understand that if people are massive fans of the books, most likely, right? You've got to be aware that it's very hard for someone to watch a film without thinking about all the books that they've read and comparing it and contrasting it. So I said, like, to remake the, which I know is a remake of the films, to redo the Harry Potter films is a TV show. It's just such a damning thing to do. You're going to spend 10 years people to only compare your stuff to the other films in the books.
Yes.
No one's going to be wondering what's going to happen in the story. We already know it's just going to be a comparison exercise. And no one's going to be able to turn that side of their brain off.
My whole attitude is always just like, how well does it function as a film in the 90 minutes, 2 hours that you're watching?
Yeah.
How well does it work as a vehicle? And if I come out of it and people say, do you know, that's so close to the book, or, you know, that's got loads of details that the original IP has, or I come out and people say, you know, that's nothing like the original, doesn't matter, because it, as long as that film, how did that film function in and of itself?
Game of Thrones, very frustrating for people who read the books, because the TV show was a very distinctively different thing. Yeah. It literally had, I literally had to do something very different with the plot at different times, different character decisions. So if you're a huge fan of the books, you're watching it being like, hey, what's going on? Well, as soon as it's not good, you're like, well, the books were like this.
Thank you, Leonora.
This next one is from Sion, friend of the show.
It's Sion.
Sion, thank you.
Hello, more James. Saltburn stuff.
More sorry, Saltburn sorry, stuff. Sorry. Hello, James and George. I know you've reviewed it a few weeks ago now, but I finally saw Saltburn italicized. I thought the performances were magnificent. I was unexpectedly taken aback by Alison Oliver's performance as Venetia because, unlike the rest of the cast, I hadn't seen her in anything before. It was overly sexual and explicit, and if there was a reason for it, maybe I would find it more tolerable. And I agree with George that Emerald Fennell has become a better director than writer.
Yes.
I found that most, if not all, of my favourite film directors also write their films. Greta Gerwig, Richard Linklater, Billy Wilder, Liza Hittman, and more. Who are some of your favourite writer-directors? Are there some that you think would do one better than the other, like Emerald Fennell being a better director? For example, I also find Christopher Nolan to be a better director than writer.
I would agree with that.
I would also like some TV recommendations. I'm so used to rewatching the same shows that I need something new. Also, it'd be interesting to know what theatre, if any, you have seen recently. As always, keep up the great work. I really enjoy listening to the podcast every week from Sion, London.
Sion, well, quite the shopping list of requests there.
Yeah,
no,
put to work.
In terms of writer-directors, I mean, like,
I think off the top of my head,
I don't know.
There probably aren't that many top ones.
I guess Tarantino.
Tarantino is probably the best.
Probably better. I mean, it's hard to it's almost harder to separate him as director and writer because he's, all, except for Jackie Brown, which he wrote the script for, but based off a previous thing, like, it's all in his mind, in his vision. Like,
I've got to give Nolan some, and Jonathan Nolan, I guess, some credit for concepts brought to life in cinema.
I totally
agree with, like, problem like Tenet, Oppenheimer.
Yeah, I still think
apart. Like, you have to get credit for.
But look at
Memento, Inception.
Yes,
like
Interstellar. I agree,
even.
But like, I like Nolan when he's tackling someone else's ideas in his own way. True. So the Dark Knight trilogy, The Prestige.
But he wrote The Dark Knight.
Yes, but it's based on an existing IP and existing. Your source material.
Yes, true.
So I agree. I know he's written this. He probably wrote the scripts for The Prestige as well, but it's all based on. I like it when he's kind of shaping someone else's vision into his own.
It's tricky, isn't it?
On the Emerald Fennell thing, yeah, I really do think I would love to see her do something based on a different IP. Now, like, in a way, you know how Greta Gerwig is doing the Narnia films for Netflix next.
Yeah,
and I was like, I almost don't want to have Greta Gerwig tied up for 5 years doing Narnia.
She's doing all of them.
I would almost rather have Emerald Fennell go do the Narnia stuff because I go that could be interesting.
Yeah,
that's an interesting proposition.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
Let Greta go back to writing, directing.
Yeah,
Emerald, go and do that.
Who do you cast as Mr. Tumnus
in the Emerald Fennell version?
Yeah,
Barry Keoghan.
Yeah, you do
with the horns and everything. You know,
totally, yeah.
And then you'd get
some ears
Rosamund Pike as the Ice Queen.
Oh my God. Bourne's play.
Right, so Richard E. Grant as Aslan.
Alive in the witch and the wardrobe.
Just with the mane.
For the whole of
mocaps. I want it mocaps. I want it on all fours.
Purring.
Rehearsing today to play Aslan in the wonderful C.S. Lewis.
And I want to get a feat. You know those like GoPro cameras of just his face? Yeah. I want the uncompressed, raw... age thing. My sister's been listening to the show and she's now finding Richard E. Grant's Instagram really funny.
He's brilliant. Have you seen his stuff from the people send me Richard E. Grant clips from his Instagram with no context when he's just like jogging. He's like,
pounding into the new year.
I read Dolly Alderton's new book, Good Material.
Yes.
And on the front cover is like loads of celebrity endorsements of the book. And I like read to him, like Aisling B, Stephen Fry, blah, blah, blah. And then there's Richard E. Grant. And I was just laughing because I just read it. It's like, completely breaks your heart and puts it back together. A dazzling piece of literature.
See, this is the thing. Make it happen. Get Emerald Fennell to direct Narnia. I want to see it now. Anyway.
This next email is from Dan, who says, long-time listener of the pod, this next email is from Dan, who says, hello, James and George, / George and James, long-time listener of the pod, way back when there was food, etc. Wanted to email in about the comfort films and how, for myself, I find most comfort films I watched when I was young. I'm a similar age to you both, and in my younger years, I had a blast flicking through my parents' mixed collection of VHSs and DVDs. Mm-hmm. Two that I came across have stuck with me forever, though, and I will always say that these are my two favorite films of all time. Not because they're objectively good or perhaps misunderstood, but because they remind me of my younger self idolizing heroes that were much lesser known. If I gave you 1,000 guesses, I'm certain you wouldn't come close. Genuinely, my two favorite films of all time are, James?
I've seen the email.
Okay. So, yeah. The Phantom, played by Billy Zane, and The Mask of Zorro.
I like The Mask of Zorro.
The Phantom is, I think I know that one.
I don't.
Is that the one, am I getting that confused with The Shadow? The Phantom, I think I've seen it on TV. Is that Alec Baldwin in it? With Billy Zane.
Oh my God.
1997.
Look at that poster.
That
shot of Billy Zane. It's like a mix between Blade.
It looks like a parody.
Yeah.
That is.
It's like Adam West Batman and The Matrix.
That is very, very interesting. And The Mask of Zorro. Yep, I bet you haven't thought about these two films in a while. And
Nobody talks about Mask of Zorro.
And yes, I die on the hill defending them every single time. A review of both would be amazing, but I understand if you want to skip them. Look. If it's on the list, it's quite low down. But the fact is, because I've never really heard of The Phantom, I'm more curious about that. I've heard of Zorro. They made two Zorro films. Yeah. Antonio Banderas, I get it. But that looks like a peculiarity.
And Anthony Hopkins.
Is in The Phantom.
No, sorry, in Mask of Zorro.
Oh, I've never seen it, so I don't know.
If anyone ever grew up with a PSP, they invented this new media format. It's so typical Sony for doing this, which was called AMD discs. They were in a plastic sort of U-shaped casing and had mini discs in them. And so you put your PSP games in the back of your PSP. But they did release like DVDs as AMDs for the PSP. And I bought like a handful of films to watch on my PSP as if that'd be fun. And one of the films was The Mask of Zorro with Antonio Banderas. And so I probably watched that film like maybe six times I just had it.
That's more than anyone's ever watched that film. Well, clearly not.
Definitely not. I think people love it. But yeah, it was good. I like Mask of Zorro.
Okay. Dan goes on to say, my question for you both is, are there any films that you adore from your childhood that are a little bit outside the usual suspects of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Harry Potter, etc.? And do you perhaps have your rose-tinted glasses on like me whenever you watch or talk about them? Mm. Please keep up the good work. I've watched so many great films based on your recommendations and also look forward to your thoughts on each. All the best, Dan from... Wales. Dan is from a village which has, I think, the longest village name. It might be a town, sorry.
Should we get Google to say it?
I don't want to be insulting to this place because it is genuinely, because he says, P.S. Yes, I'm actually from this place.
Gav would help us out right here.
Oh, God. It is...
That was the weirdest video I've ever seen.
There's a video of Liam Dutton, the weather presenter, pronouncing it, and we're going to get it just up a second.
Right, are we ready? Stand by.
But in the sunshine in northwest Wales at RAF Mona, just up the road from Llanbair Pwllgwyng, gellwch chi gael eich drobwch, Llantysilio Gogogoch.
Oh my God.
You win the award for listener from the place with the best name. And that's why I'm just going to say Wales. Dan, thank you for your email.
This last one for today is from Tom. Tom, who puts the subject, helping James to understand wrestling. A couple of weeks ago, I reviewed The Iron Claw, and I thought the film was
coming out next month.
Which I had lots about it that I liked, but sort of failed to sort of reach the highs I thought it could have. But one of my sort of gripes with it, for me personally, as a non-wrestling fan and as a semi-sports film, but also a sort of tragedy, is that I don't think the film communicated clearly enough how the very basics of like progression in wrestling works. Mm. And it was a little bit lost on me. And the film had a sort of dramatic tension over who would win or who would do better, when in my eyes, it's prearranged.
Yes.
And I just couldn't really let go of it, even though there was a lot about the film that I really enjoyed. And I did ask the science, someone who knew wrestling more than me, could come in and relieve me of my pain. Tom writes in, says, helping James to understand wrestling. Hi, guys. Tom from a village somewhere in the middle of Norfolk here. Vague. I'm actually a time traveler. Well, not really, but a friend introduced me to the show, so I started from the beginning. Currently on episode 54, and interested to know if Avatar holds up. Remember that one?
Yeah.
Have you watched Avatar? But I also listen to your new episodes for things I've seen or I'm excited to see. But I've just listened to James's review of The Iron Claw, and I knew my time to speak had arrived.
Welcome.
I haven't seen the film yet, brackets, February 9th seems a long way away, but I'm a long-time wrestling fan. From being a child of the late 90s, watching the golden age of The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin, in the early 2000s, I remember seeing John Cena arrive as a plucky underdog in a feud with Kurt Angle and Chris Jericho, and I still watch various forms of wrestling to this day. I think James's issue with understanding how wrestling works is a framing issue. Wrestling isn't something that can be directly compared to something like boxing or MMA. Yes, the fight is important, but wrestling is more like a long-running soap opera. Wrestlers are characters, and long-term storylines are interwoven. On an average wrestling show, like WWE Raw, only about 25% of the show would be made up of matches. The rest of the time is spent advancing storylines. Then the pay-per-view elements, events will be mostly matches, where the storylines either advance or end. In most cases, the wrestling you can look at like in a comic book movie. In most cases with wrestling, you can look at it like a comic book movie. There are always going to be bad guys, and the bigger the bad guy is, the more they're going to win. But you know that in the end, a hero will come and take down the villain. So in the same way that there are stakes when you're watching the Avengers take on Thanos, there are stakes when watching top babyface, brackets good guy, take on the top heel bad guy. And sometimes you might be annoyed that it was Spider-Man that took him down, because you'd have preferred if it was Captain America. But as long as the story that gets you there makes sense and is cathartic, you'll be satisfied. To advance slightly further on the comment George made about how The Rock or John Cena became the top dog, it comes down to a combination of audience reaction and what the boys in the office want. In the case of The Rock, although he was a third generation performer, it took him some time to find a character that connected with audiences. As soon as he found that character, a rocket was strapped to his back. In the case of John Cena, it was a little more of an office thinking that he embodied what they wanted their product to look like, a bit of a cheesy Superman type who'll ruffle the kids' hair and tell them to eat their greens. To get to the top, a wrestler really needs athletic ability, charisma, the ability to tell a compelling story, and a whole lot of support from the people who make the decisions. Hope that helps. Keep up the good work. I look forward to the day where I listen in real time and don't find myself mentally composing emails about things you talked about 18 months ago. Tom. Thank you, Tom. That is helpful. And that's all roughly what I kind of thought. As I stand, the film it's about wrestling and progression. Doesn't quite communicate that to me.
So I'm still a bit confused how... I haven't seen The Iron Claw, but I assume you have a character in the dressing room being like, God damn it, how are we going to get through this? How are we going to... Oh, like, yeah. I was so close. And I'm thinking, but where's the difference? What difference could you have made?
There's moments where they train, like in a Rocky movie, for a fight, where it's like, I have to train hard because I need to beat...
Maybe they're just... I guess is the key that they're not trying to beat the opponent, they're trying to win the audience.
Yeah, but you've got like the technique and the learning.
And the Iron Claw. The name is the maneuver, right?
It could have been lost in me. And I'm probably putting way too much attention on it than it needs to divert from what the film's really about. But that does sit there for me.
Okay.
As wondering.
The thing is, now it's in my head and I'll go and see it.
And there's even moments when like they're backstage with the person they're fighting with. And they'll be like, okay, so you do that and then you suplex me. And yeah, guys, let's have a good time. Let's do it. Break. And I'm like, oh, okay, so there's like a camaraderie. Yeah. Like, I'm going to fight you, but like, let's all do this and don't do that too early because I'm going to have to come in afterwards. Yeah. Cool, that's quite interesting. And then they're enemies, but how do we... Anyway. I'm really going on way too long. But that's all the emails for today.
We've
got loads. Thank you
very much for sending them in. We'll get to them more next week. We will finish this episode of 2024 with, as usual, James.
Okay.
Thank you. James, time for a game. Before we broke up for the holidays last year, I played a new game for you where it was a spin-off of Caster's Countdown. A Co-Star Countdown. Yes. Where I basically gave you two actors and you had to tell me yes or no whether they've been in a film together.
Okay.
Okay. I'm just going to combine two actors, you know, and I've made a great list.
Mm-hmm.
I've found some interesting discoveries in my research as well. Because I'll put some actors together and then I'll go, let me just check if they ever did do a film together. Yeah. And I'll go, wait, what? So that's very interesting.
It's quite hard because sometimes you gave me ones that were so ridiculous. I'm like, is this so ridiculous because he's giving me an easy one? Or is it ridiculous because they have actually
been
in a movie together?
That's the fun part of the game. So mm-hmm. the whole game again, I've got two rounds of this for you.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm going to name two actors and you have to tell me yes or no whether they've been in a film together.
Okay.
Tell me yes or no, did these actors appear in a film together? Hilary Swank and George Clooney.
Yes.
No. Denzel Washington and Keanu Reeves.
Yes.
Yes. Much Ado About Nothing. Samuel L. Jackson and Gary Oldman.
Oh, did they do a film? I'm going to say no.
They did. It was True Romance. Aaron Eckhart and Sandra Bullock.
Yes.
No.
Shit.
Winona Ryder and Alec Baldwin.
No.
Yes, Beetlejuice. Christian Bale and Johnny Depp.
Oh. No.
Yes, they're in Public Enemies, Michael Mann's film.
Oh, yes, of course.
Jim Carrey and Richard E. Grant.
Jim Carrey and Richard E. Grant. Going to say no.
No, correct, yeah. John Malkovich and Ben Stiller.
Oh, they were. I'm going to say yes.
Yes, they're in Empire of the Sun together.
Okay.
Julia Roberts and Jason Alexander.
Julia, ooh, yes.
Yes, they're in Pretty Woman together.
Yes.
And lastly, Kate Blanchett and Nicolas Cage.
Kate Blanchett and Nicolas Cage? Oh, he's done so many weird things. I'm going to go yes.
No.
No, oh, shit. Considering it's 50-50, I didn't do that well.
I thought the Jason Alexander one would throw you, but yeah, he's quite a big part actually. And he's a pre-Seinfeld or just done the first season of Seinfeld. In Pretty Woman. And he plays basically just a sleazy version of George.
Yeah, yeah, I remember.
Well
done. He tries to like sexually assault her.
Yes, it's very nasty. Yeah. He's the main antagonist in that movie, but really like they lump all the antagonism on him. Like for some reason, he gets really annoyed that Richard Gere's involved with Julia Roberts.
It's a really weird like culmination to like the end of the film to bring some sort of like tension in a film that's mostly like a nice fantasy.
James, I'm going to give you a second round now. Are you ready? James, yes or no? Did these two actors appear in a film together?
Okay.
3, 2, 1, Sylvester Stallone and Sarah Silverman.
I'd say no.
No. Zac Efron and Robert De Niro.
Yes, Bad Grandpa.
Dirty Grandpa.
Dirty Grandpa.
Chris Evans and Cillian Murphy.
Chris Evans and Cillian Murphy. I'm going to guess yes.
Yes, in Danny Boyle's Sunshine.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Black and Madonna.
No.
No. Margot Robbie and Channing Tatum.
I'm going to go no.
Robert Downey Jr. and Sarah Jessica Parker.
I'm going to go no.
Yes, they were in a movie called Firstborn, and then they dated for 7 years.
Whoa, okay.
Lastly, Michael Caine and Steven Seagal.
Oh, I'm going to go no.
Yes.
They did.
It's a film called On Deadly Ground.
Okay, well, there you go.
There you go.
Nice. Those are good.
Cast as combos.
Yeah, cast as combos.
Co-star combos?
Co-star combos.
Co-star combos.
Co-star combos.
Wish I thought of that before I did it.
Yeah,
I could have said
Co-star combos.
That's the new title for this.
That's fun to say.
Yeah, that film with Steven Seagal and Michael Caine has 12% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Ooh, that's low.
I just finished a book about action heroes, and Steven Seagal is talked about that, and what a strange man.
No,
I'm not particularly personal. I'm not relishing watching his films because they look rubbish, and he doesn't seem like a very nice person.
No.
Seem, never met the guy.
I know things about Steven Seagal.
You
that
do.
Make
your hair cry. There you go. That was our those were our combos there. That was this episode of Pulp Kitchen. We don't forget, we have a bonus episode coming out this mm-hmm. week, which is going to be really fun. A quick sort of run through of all the films that we watched over the Christmas period, both new and
caught
old.
Up with.
Exactly.
The ones from like sort of October to Christmas period that we missed.
And James, what do you say to people at the end of every episode?
Guys, don't forget, we post new episodes of this show every single Wednesday.
The bonus will be out on Friday. And please continue to like and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok, and also our YouTube page. We've got loads of stuff on YouTube Shorts as well. If you're just a little bit bored, want to kill some time, and you're like, you know what? I've seen all the YouTube videos. I'll watch them on YouTube Shorts as well. There's that as well.
Mm.
Please continue to spread the word. We really appreciate all your support. All your emails are so lovely. Mm-hmm. They really do make us feel good.
Guys, the new year was great numbers-wise for us in the top 10. So
and
thank you so much
you.
For supporting us in the new year.
Anyway, enjoy your week. See you then next week.
Bye.
I did that badly. See you next week then. Good. My brain is broken. I'm hungry. Goodbye.